Well, hello everybody, welcome to another one-liner podcast from the Edinburgh International Film Festival. We've got a few films to cover here, so we'll just get cracking on with it. I am Scott Morris, and with me, Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
Let's have no further ado. Not actually all that much ado in the first place, but let's just skip the whole ado thing and go straight into a film review of Dummy. Drew?
Yes, Dummy, a British film about brothers Jack and Danny who live with their mother in Brighton. 18-year-old Danny spends his time DJing and smoking, while Jack, who's still at school, spends his time bird-watching, or at least that's when he's not cleaning and indulging in his obsession with preparing trays of food or tea for people. Danny seems to have a fairly healthy and normal relationship with his mother. Jack, on the other hand, is a right weird little bastard, who is far too close to his mother for anyone's good, though that's in a clingy, mummy's boy kind of way, rather than an Oedipal way. He also insists on calling her mummy in a particularly irritating way that, after hearing him say mummy more than a couple of times, you wish you could take his birdwatching binoculars off of him and stave his head in, just you wouldn't have to hear him say it again. One night, while they're on a family trip to their seaside cottage, their ill mother overdoses on her pain medication. She's found in the morning by Jack, who urges Danny to do something to help her. She's clearly well beyond any help, but Jack manages to delay Danny calling anyone in for quite some time. When a doctor and funeral home workers finally do arrive to remove her body, the weird little mummy's boy won't let go and clings onto the corpse of his mother for as long as possible. Yeah, so left to fend for themselves by their mother's death, a social worker pays them a visit. Their mother's will makes it clear that in the event of her death, she wants Jack to be looked after by his older brother, who says he's prepared to do this, and the social worker, in a way completely unlike reality, decides there and then to agree to Danny becoming Jack's legal guardian. So, being a parent to his younger brother, he deals with his new parental role by not dealing with it, and largely leaves Jack to his own devices as he goes out drinking, smoking, and drug-taking with his new girlfriend. Already missing his mother, little Jack begins to talk to her as if she's alive and answering back, and eventually the lone little boy creates a mummy replacement, that's the dummy of the title, using a mannequin in his mother's wig and clothes. He starts spending more and more time with it until he's very deeply and unhealthily attached. In the meantime, Danny smokes some more and nothing much happens. And also it happens in a Brighton that the directors contrive to make look like a ghost town, which just makes the film even duller because nothing's happening anywhere. Now, the biggest problem with Dummy though, other than simply not being very interesting, is the casting of the two brothers. Almost the entire film rests on the two boys, and they are, to put not too fine a point in it, shit. I mean, I don't say that to be nasty, I'm simply stating facts. Aaron Johnson's performance as Danny, it lacks energy and his emotional scenes are strained, but as he's only really called upon to smoke some and look sullen, he never has to stretch his acting muscles much. The younger brother, Jack, played by Thomas Grant, is something else entirely. He's at the centre of the film, and for it to have any chance of working, he has to be at least sympathetic, but it's far, far beyond him. He's a right creepy little kid, and rather than being endearingly weird or frighteningly, disturbingly weird, either of which would have worked, he's just instead deeply, deeply, unlikably weird. He lacks any conviction in his role, and in the scene where he rages at his brother for spilling milk on his recently cleaned floor is entirely unconvincing. And again, I don't say this to be nasty, but I know good child actors can be quite hard to find, but they're certainly to be found. For examples, I point you towards the two child stars of Son of Rambo and the exciting talent that is Thomas Turgis. So it's unfortunately just a dull film with poor performances and to be avoided really at all costs because you will not like it. Unless you're Hannah McGill. Possibly you want to cut that bit out.
By this point I don't care. So this is another film up for the Michael Powell Awards with Summer's Town and a few other things that pretty much look like Summer's Town's going to be a shoo-in for this.
Yes, well, another film I saw, Summer, is good, but it's not as good as Summer's Town. Mm-hmm. So if it doesn't get it, something's gone deeply wrong.
Yeah, I've looked at Dummy, had no interest in it whatsoever. Only thing I can see that may be interesting, the music by Clint Mansell. Any good? Even noticeable?
So yeah, the music, it was quite good actually, but...
Right, so we're saying get the soundtrack for this and ignore the film.
Yeah, right. That would work, but even then,
And is that your final word?
Meh, meh.
Fair dues then. In which case, I will go on with Fujian Blue, another of the Asian contingent to hit Edinburgh's streets during this festival. It's the feature debut from the director Robin Wang, purporting to be a study of his native Fujian province in southeast China. The main thrust of the piece is illegal immigration, however, and for those in Britain who are convinced by the faux outrage from the Daily Mail decrying them as responsible for all of this country's ills, perhaps ought to be forced to watch this problem through eyes that immigration is as much of a problem for China, and more pressingly an immediate and massive problem for those doing the emigrating, than it is for anyone in this country. Incidentally, if anyone has actually worked out how to live and work in Britain and still have any money left over to send anywhere, then please let me know, because it's not something I've been able to do so far in my life. The structure of Fujian Blues somewhat odd, for want of a better term. We're initially introduced to a group of young men who seem mostly concerned with spending money on drink, drugs and karaoke bars, which, while perhaps pointless, isn't that much different from the aims of many kids across the world. Of more immediate cause for concern is the way they make their money, in this case by taking advantage of the large number of remittance widows in the more affluent areas of the city. These are women who are kept in relative affluence, living on the money sent from husbands overseas who have went abroad to seek their fortune and send the cash back to them. Being naturally lonely as a byproduct of this, many of them seek comfort in the arms of young lovers, which is where our gang and the video camera comes in. They operate a sort of honey trap outfit, with one of the gang seducing a target and the others capturing proof to be used for a bit of blackmail. It's very enterprising, and for a short while this scam sees them in good stead, until one of the gang, America, played by Zhu Xiaopeng, decides to teach his mother a lesson for some perceived wrongdoing by setting her up for their unique treatment. It's clear from the outset that this isn't a particularly good idea, particularly when America's mother relates what's going on to the local triad boss, whom she's very friendly with. With a ruthless crime syndicate about to start an investigation into their activities, the gang decide to take a well-advised trip to their coastal hometown, and at which point the film changes tack so suddenly and completely that the film might as well have chopped itself in two, abruptly turning from a nominal thriller structure into a more sedate and thoughtful examination of the reasons why a young Chinese person would risk the crippling debts to crime syndicates and for most years of effectual slavery to triad outfits in whichever country they end up in, assuming that they survive, of course. In particular, this looks at the decision of one of the gang named Dragon, played by Lao Jin, looking to go abroad seemingly less out of any personal greed than a need to help out his struggling family, for whom the fishing industry's decline is proving to be somewhat of a pain, especially when they're already deep in debt to triad bosses for fees sending other family members overseas. With the narrative taking less of a driving seat in this section, it becomes in danger of becoming as much of a picture postcard as a piece of drama. However, a sympathetic turn from Lao Jin means that this pretty much carries off the thematic change, which could quite easily have sunk the whole film entirely. The director does pull off this move, but only just. It is somewhat annoying that the promising thriller that was developed in the first half is so suddenly and jarringly yanked away, and the plot threads are rather abruptly severed rather than tied up through a few Deus Ex Machinas and overseen TV broadcasts, and this allows the second part to occur pretty much unhindered by the first part of the film and the events thereof, and it does rather beg the question of why this film has so obviously and deliberately been designed as two wholly separate films cut and shut together that merely happen to share the same cast. Still, as long as you're not predisposed to find that sort of thing inordinately irritating, then there's quite a lot to like in the film. The performances, with a few minor exceptions from some bit part characters, are never less than good and often rather great. While in the early running it seems that it may dissolve into a communist propaganda piece, it never quite gets that bad, and there does seem to be some undercurrent of critique to the regime, at least as much as can be expressed, and still hope to get past the Chinese censorship boards. Perhaps the most heartrending moment of the film is reserved for the credit rolls, as a telephone interview of a mother whose child had left for Britain some time ago and has yet to be heard from plays out. It's her wish that he was not one of those killed in that little cockle-picking incident back in Morecambe a few years back, although she's not entirely sure, and if that doesn't tug on the heartstrings, I'm not sure what else will. It is certainly one of the better films I've seen this festival, even despite its strange structure and, in places, not massively likable protagonists. But yeah, one of the better films so far.
It sounds quite interesting. But does it offer any answers as to why so many people would want to risk so much and get so in debt to leave? Or is that the sort of thing you might think might not get past the censors?
Well, it is essentially the same kind of thing that we saw in Welcome to Wonderland. They think they'll be able to go abroad and make money, and of course a lot of people do, and that's why there are these remittance windows, as people are sending reasonable sums of money back to China, and your dollar does go a bit further over there than it does here. Of course, the risks of winding up, you know, mopping floors for a living somewhere in deepest, darkest London or Czechoslovakia or something along those lines is fairly extreme as well. So, as with most things in life, it comes down to money. There's no real indication that they're particularly looking for a freer life or there's any political oppression. It is simply a case of it's the only way to make any decent money without becoming part of a crime syndicate.
Yeah, well, because, of course, huge parts of China are still very much a peasant economy to all intents and purposes, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't exactly sound uplifting viewing, but worthwhile, I would imagine.
Yeah, certainly not uplifting, but if you can get a hold of it, I'd certainly recommend it. Next up, a film again I couldn't be bothered with, but Warsaw Dark. Drew, what say you about this?
I say this about this. The move from one creative discipline to another, in this case a move from a chair marked director of photography to one simply marked director, is not always going to work, and unfortunately this is certainly true of Christopher Doyle. The Sydney-born cinematographer has worked in the past with the likes of Philip Nice, Zhang Yimou and Wong Kar-wai, creating some truly beautiful and memorable films. Notable amongst these are such great pieces as Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love in 2046 and Zhang Yimou's Hero, which is still one of the most beautiful looking films I've ever clapped my eyes upon. So that he has a true gift for lighting and composition is clear. Alas, the same cannot be said of his direction. In Warsaw Dark, his second feature in the big chair, though it has been 9 years since his first, he's clearly crying out for the storytelling ability of Wong Kar-wai, etc. In the past, his direction from Kar-wai could have gone along the lines of, here, please make this look pretty, I'll deal with the story. And perhaps after performing his piece, he ought to have paid more attention to what the director was doing. In Warsaw Dark, he manages the first part with aplomb, but the narrative is posted missing in action. It's set in contemporary, or near enough contemporary, Warsaw, and the story is apparently inspired by the murder of the Polish Minister for Sport by criminal bosses looking to protect their interests. The minister was lured to his death by a prostitute who was subsequently caught but refused to reveal the names of her accomplices. Fortunately, all of this seems entirely incidental in Warsaw Dark, which dispenses with the assassination of the minister within the first 5 minutes and has the prostitute Oika drugged and kidnapped to spend the rest of the film in various moodily lit rooms and corridors while the assassination is then relegated to the background. Whilst being held, Oika is subjected to what is presumably meant to be psychological conditioning in order to get her to work again for the criminal gang, but it all seems very, very half-hearted. Meanwhile, in the outside world, a police detective attempts to find Oika, though apparently not to bother questioning her about the murder, but rather because her mum asked him to. Oh yeah, and he wants to get it all wrapped up before he goes on holiday to Mallorca with his wife next week. So as a police procedural, Warsaw Dark doesn't work, as the investigation seems to jump from one stage to the next, without all of that inconvenient finding things out and following lead stuff in between. Quite how they eventually find Oika is utterly beyond me, though perhaps they just asked Davina McCall, as for most of the film she does appear to be imprisoned alone in the Big Brother house. It doesn't work as a thriller either, as there is no tension and no perceived sense of danger to any character. Oh, and also because it makes bugger all sense. It's without doubt a good looking film, with the possible exceptions of the exterior daytime shots of Warsaw, which is quite possibly the grimmest, greyest city I've ever seen. And also, and being an unabashed fan of beautiful leggy brunettes, the main character is certainly easy on the eye. However, none of this comes even close to making this impenetrable mess worth your time, and I would advise anybody listening to give this particular film a wide berth.
Doesn't sound particularly appealing in any way, shape or form, does it? When I read things like the Oika being the film's emotional core as well as its lust object, she is controlled by a pimp but driven by love for her hitman boss, and it sounds sort of stereotypical thriller 101 right in there.
Yeah, well, there's the thing though. Once again, that's got me thinking, did the person who wrote that in the press blurb actually see the same film I did?
Hello, Hannah McGill, how are you?
Because there is no pimp, as far as I was aware. There's possibly somebody in the car at the start. But she's certainly not controlled by a pimp, because for almost the entirety of the film, she's locked in a room with one man. Locked in a house with one man, who's mostly watching her through videos and doing his half-arsed attempt to brainwash her.
So it's wrong again. I should stop reading this. I should stop reading these things. Not massively convincing.
And also, the story just makes no sense. Things jump along, and unless I fell asleep, and I know it was near to it at some point, but I'm damn sure I didn't, or possibly looked away for a second, characters get mentioned that I'm certain weren't there. Or the police detective goes to question somebody, and he mentions the fact that after somebody else talked to him, he died. But this person was never mentioned before. Just huge jumps like that, and then all of a sudden, they find her. Well, how'd that happen? Apparently it was due to the convenient fact of he told one of his subordinates, go and search for some stuff, let me know when you have it. And a little while later, he got a text message on his phone saying, I found some stuff.
I found the end of the film. Go to here.
Yeah, it's a hideous mess.
I do start to worry when I start seeing people comparing it to, oh, it's like David Lynch, because that normally means it makes no sense, although it isn't actually enjoyable in the way that David Lynch is.
Yeah, that's the thing. David Lynch, mostly because, I mean, there's still some plot to David Lynch films, and certainly tends to get good performances out of it and strong visual style, and, you know, David Lynch can get away with it, possibly because they're so screamingly mad and have backwards-talking dwarfs that it becomes so weird or so bad that it's good. But this is just—it's just terrible.
Another one to give the body swerve to.
Oh yes.
Right, we've reached that special point in the podcast where I question why on earth did I buy Budweiser, a beer I can barely tolerate. And not only that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about a film called With a Girl of Black Soil. Now, I do love watching Korean films, mainly because it gives me another chance to look at their wacky alphabet. And of course, the hit rate of Korean films that have made it through customs to Britain of late has been quite high. Park Chan-wook remains one of the most imaginative and intense filmmakers working today, and Kai Duk Kim continues to put out masterful works of bleakness. Even the poorer K-horrors and mainstream stuff like The Host and A Bittersweet Life have never quite hit the lows we're used to seeing from Hollywood these days. With A Girl of Black Soil certainly eschews the hyperkinetic intensity of Park's stuff, but perhaps you could argue it's similar in tone to Kim's The Isle or last year's festival outing Breath. Director Soo Il-jeon's fourth feature outing has certainly paid up its membership to the increasingly popular South Korean Films with Nearly No Dialogue Club. But crucially, it also features the same mesmerising hold over an audience despite its minimalist storyline. Set in a snowbound mining village, which is perhaps best described as a one-horse town where someone has shot the horse, the changing economic climate of the country means that the mines are in the process of shutting down. Bad news for a town whose economy is based entirely on it, but there's also an additional layer of unpleasantness for the father of two, played by Young Jin-jo. He's taken and diagnosed with a bout of pneumoconiosis, or black lung to give it its more ominous Dungeons & Dragons villain pseudonym. He can't work down to pit anymore, and so struggles to find alternative employment to provide for his family. Increasingly, he turns to drink for solace. This leaves the almost impossibly cute young daughter, Young Lim, played expertly by Yun Mi Yu, to look after her mentally handicapped older brother, who has a physical age of 12 and a mental age of perhaps a quarter that. This, for a while at least, doesn't work out quite as badly as you'd expect, with the 8-year-old daughter proving to be the most mature of the lot of them, at least until she takes some necessary and some extreme actions towards the end of the film. Now, and I do seem to be saying this an awful lot during this year's festival coverage, there's not an awful lot going on here in any quantifiable sense. Indeed, the supplied press synopsis runs to about 4 sentences and does describe pretty much everything of note that happens in the film. It's not a film that I can sell to you on its actions. It places rather more faith, bravely I would say, in the performance of the 9-year-old actress or thereabouts, Yun Mi Yu. It pays off, and regardless of how realistic such a character might be with the combination of mature responsibility and childish innocence, it is a compelling one, especially when contrasted with her father's self-destruction. With a focus on the bleak environs of the town and community, it's a visually effective film, albeit one that couldn't be described as pretty. The slow build of events card is perhaps somewhat overplayed, as there are very few events over a very long time, or so it seems. The middle third does drag quite a bit, and while only 90 minutes, it does seem odd to be calling for a shorter film, but a good 10 minutes lopped off the running time might have promoted this to being an excellent film rather than being a good one. As you might gather, I did rather enjoy this film, although giving you a concrete list of reasons proves to be a little difficult, but then it always is for this sort of thing. The the film is, particularly if you enjoyed the bleak, minimalist recent films of Kai Duk Kim, and if his work does sound interesting, please check out the website for reviews of The Isle, Breathe and Bad Guy. I'm aware at this point I'm trying to recommend that you see an obscure film based on its likeness to barely less obscure films, so perhaps I should quit while I'm ahead. This will, by its very nature, be a film that's not going to be accepted by a mass market, but there's no chance a mass market is ever going to stumble across it. You're going to have to make an effort to seek this out, and unless you have a fairly high tolerance for this sort of near eventless thing, you're probably not going to like it. However, in this case, I'd say your patience will be rewarded, and it is actually a film I would recommend. Drew, any thoughts on this?
I very much enjoyed this film, but I'm frankly at the stage of, I'm buggered if I know why. Well, not in any way that I could put down a bit of paper and give to somebody saying, these are the good things about this film. The girl's performance is excellent. I tell you, probably not believable in real life, but certainly a compelling character in that she's having the maturity of having to look after her family forced upon her, which is something that happens a lot around the world every day, but still having that childlike innocence and playfulness, which is probably saving her. So the character's good, and the actress is, for somebody so young, it's impressive.
It is masterful. It's very, very charming without ever seeming precocious or, you know, just irritating, yes. Which it could quite easily have been.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than a precocious little child that you'd rather just slap than watch the film. Well, I'm advocating child abuse here by slapping children, but I'm sure anybody who's seen bratty children films knows exactly what I mean. The only thing I disagree with you on is the running time, because I didn't feel it dragged on at all. I was quite happy with how far it ran, but other than that, I would mostly agree with you.
Yeah. So effectively you're saying it's an even better film than I am, so we're in a concurrence that this is a good film, and this is a good thing.
Yes. It's certainly one of the films with the least amount of dialogue I've seen in quite some time. So for those people who don't like foreign language films because they don't want to have to read a film, it's probably for you.
Next up out the barrel, Slingshot.
Yes, Slingshot. And I am not going to spend much time on this for my sake and yours, dear listeners, because not a lot happens, it's not worthwhile, so I'll just give you the skinny and tell you not to watch it. Unfortunately,
okay, moving on.
Yeah, unfortunately, with a number of films this year's festival, I found it just to be not a lot happens and it's dull and there has characters you don't care about. Unfortunately, it seems to be a theme for some of the poorer films this year, and this is no exception. I shall tell you something about it anyhow. Directed by Filipino director Brillante Mendoza, Slingshot uses portable hidden cameras to capture life in the slums of Manila. Starting in the middle of the night with an imminent police raid, the film whizzes through the lives of those unfortunate enough to have to dwell in the shittiest of places. We follow a handful of characters as they go about their daily lives, but unfortunately these lives seem to consist of petty thievery, gambling, robbery and heroin smoking. Being set in a slum and featuring non-professionals as much of the cast, there are obvious parallels to Fernando Morales' City of God, but really the two can be more disparate. Whereas City of God sets us up with characters and a story arc and gives us a reason to care about them as we see their lives progress throughout the years, Slingshot is impersonal and utterly ineffective. We're given no more than cursory introductions to characters and can see no more than the most tenuous of links between them, i.e. that they all live in the same slum and might happen to know each other's name. As the film flips from one inhabitant of the slum to the other, we are given no time to engage with the character nor to determine whether we might care what happens to them. We might come back to them, we might not. Though as the most exciting thing that happens to anyone is the loss of some false teeth, it's really not worth caring anyway.
Personally, I think more films should be about lost dentures. There's a seam of drama there that's yet to be mined fully, I believe.
Yes, it's the new dental reality films.
Now, Shane Meadows, your next project must be about lost false teeth.
I would like to come back again. I don't mean to particularly to pick on Hannah McGill, but she seems to be most raw most often, as far as I'm concerned. In the press blurb that she wrote for Slingshot,
and I should point out, just in case we didn't last time, Hannah McGill has organised this festival, so she does theoretically know some things about film, or has convinced someone at some point that she does.
I find myself disagreeing with her so very often. Mendoza's close-up style commands that the character's concerns become her own. So absorbed are we in the detail of these lives that the loss of a prized set of dentures becomes as nail-biting as an armed standoff.
See, I told you, it's dramatic.
Yes, I suppose that's technically correct. But not because the last dentures are so exciting that anything that happens in the film is so dull that they're all one level of dullness. Another big problem with this is that there's simply no sense of time passing. It's a particular bugbear of mine in a lot of films. And the film really could take place over a day or over a year, when only a death followed by a funeral suggests that at some point since the film began, the sun has set and risen at least once. The handheld and sometimes hidden cameras and the use of a lot of footage of real members of the public make it feel like a documentary, but it's a documentary simply with nothing worthwhile to say. The only thing you could possibly get out of it is that life in this slum in Manila is shit. But I know it's shit. It's a slum. You say the word slum, people are instantly going to know, that'd be a shitty place to live then. It tells you nothing useful. It doesn't present much evidence of why these people would do the things they do, other than the fact that with poverty comes the higher instance of crime, and it's just an entirely redundant piece that works neither as drama nor documentary, has nothing to say, and doesn't give you a chance to care about any of the characters. So best avoided.
I've not seen this, but I'm recommending it purely on the basis that it's directed by Brillante Mendoza, which has to be the best name, with the possible exception of Danny and Oxide Pang, for a director that I've ever heard. So yeah, another one to dodge. We're certainly doing well on the bad films front, aren't we?
If by well you mean incredibly unlucky, then yes, we're doing very well.
Luck has nothing to do with it. It's pure skill in picking the bad films. The things aren't getting noticeably better when I start talking about Gloss, the director's cut. I'm not sure if there is a cut that is not the director's cut, but nevertheless it's subtitled the director's cut in this country. Now, I love watching Russian films, mainly because it gives me another chance to look at their wacky alphabet. This outing from director Andrei Konchalovsky purports to be a satire of sorts on the world of high fashion, which observant audiences will know has already been flogged seemingly to death by Prêt-à-Porter and The Devil Wears Prada, and perhaps a bunch of other films, but it's not exactly a subgenre of cinema I pay close attention to, so you'll have to forgive my complete lack of caring. I suppose Konchalovsky has also noticed that the seam has been mined pretty much completely, as throughout this film, there's a very real sense of it being made up on the spot. Following the life of Galia, played by Ilya Kuryakin, as she upsticks from a humdrum life as a seamstress in a coal mining town, leaving her small-time gangster boyfriend and moving to Moscow, dreaming of making it big as a model. We are introduced to a bitchy fashion magazine editor and her equally bitchy daughter, whose relationship seems to be important to the film for about 15 minutes before they're rudely dropped from the face of the earth entirely, which is round about where I questioned what exactly this film is supposed to be focusing on and what, if anything, it's trying to say. As the film goes on, neither of these questions are answered in any particular fashion. After working for a cliched fashion designer who puts out collections subtitled 100% shit, and at which point I was really hoping that Zoolander's Bugatti would show up and show off his Derelicte range, Galia goes off to work in a high-class whorehouse come marriage arrangement service before catching the eye of one of the corrupt oligarchs who's in between wives and also London-based football teams, one assumes. It's presented as a modern absurdist fairy tale, and I suppose on at least some level it does work as that. Regardless of how unpleasant the characters, or at least their desires are, everyone does seem to get what they want of the arrangements made, and no one does seem to be getting hurt in the process, so I suppose that's okay in this Moscow where love seems to be an entirely alien or at least outmoded concept. The level it doesn't work on is on having any sort of coherent focus or any noticeable attempt at social commentary. Without this, it pretty much turns into 2 hours of Russians bawling at each other, and it's not particularly easy on the ears, or, despite the presence of largely knackered models flouting about, particularly easy on the eyes, with the overdriven visual stylings smattered about the place, not so much detracting from things as simply provoking the question of why they were shoehorned in there in the first place. For all of its structural failings, I have to concede that Gloss is not, in fact, a miserable way to spend 2 hours in a cinema. It's pacey and punchy enough to bomb through what little passes for a story without seeming to drag, and it is, in a colourful, glossy and entirely vacuous way, more or less enjoyable to someone with no interest whatsoever in the subject matter. One supposes, and this supposition it is important to realise is pulled entirely from my ass with no verification whatsoever, that it may prove rather appealing to the Sex and the City crowd, with the added advantage of featuring only one poster of that horse-faced Harrod and Sarah Jessica Parker rather than an entire film full of her. That said, the official TheOneLiner.com recommendation is still to watch Zoolander instead because it has David Bowie in it. I struggle to care about this film, would perhaps be a better way of putting it. Drew, any thoughts?
It's kind of hard to try and create a parody or satire of something that is a walking satire of itself all the time anyway. And it's such, the whole idea of high fashion is such a ridiculous world. That anything attempted to try and satirise it is redundant with the possible exception of Zoolander, which you mentioned, and quite within the film I was wishing it was Zoolander. It just didn't seem to have a great deal of point. I mean, I was reasonably entertained by it, and there were certainly some funny moments, including the main character, Galia, channeling the horse-faced Harrod and Sarah Jessica Parker in her horse-like walk down the catwalk. Yeah, it just seemed largely pointless in the end for a film set out to be some sort of satire, critique of this fashion world in Russia. And you mentioned also about the editor woman being dropped and never mentioned again, really. And also, when she's first introduced, there's a strange moment where she and her photographer boyfriend pretend they're in a Bollywood film, which just jars with the rest of the film because that sort of device isn't repeated again and didn't seem appropriate with characters you'd only just been introduced to.
And seemed borderline racist.
Yes, which, given the state of Russia, is probably not too surprising, but it's still not pleasant to watch.
I should mention the lead actress. It's not actually Ilya Kuryakin. It's Yulia Vyotskaya, I think. Apologies if I'm mincing the words there, but that's as close as I can get to it with my limited range of Russian.
I didn't even bother trying to mention the actress in Warsaw Dark, because it's far worse, because the Polish dislike vowels even more than the Welsh do. I didn't even begin to try and say that name.
Glossy is essentially a shiny bauble you could watch for 2 hours without ruining your appetite between proper films.
Yeah. The one other thing I would say too is the only message it seems to come across is they pay a little bit of lip service via the main character's best friend about her agency being nothing more than a whorehouse and that she and her boss are effectively pimps. And it's largely dismissed because apparently pimping women is okay if the sums of money involved are large enough.
Yeah.
Which isn't really a very pleasant thing to say, and it's clearly wrong, but never seemed to get quite deep enough into that, which might have been a bit more interesting, but just abandoned that, and the film was as lightweight as the title would suggest.
So, another swing and a miss.
Right, so that brings us to the end of this podcast, but we'll be back with you very soon, having consumed some more films, and we'll tell you about them very shortly. So, for now, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him. I'm so good.